Readers Entertainment Radio presents Book Lights with your host, author Lisa Kessler. Book Lights, where we're shining a light on good books.
You heard that, everyone listening out there. It's Halloween time. It's my season. And I'm so excited because this year, kicking off our Halloween shows for the month of October, we have New York Times best-selling author Christopher Rice. And he is so much fun, you guys. I can't wait for you to meet him. And if you haven't read his books yet, you are in for a treat because he has written books that just cover the gamut of genres. And I will read his bio right now so that you can get to know him better. Christopher Rice is an Amazon Charts best-selling author whose works include Bone Music, Blood Echo, and the Burning Girls series, the New York Times bestseller A Destiny of Souls, and the Bram Stoker Award finalist The Heavens Rise and The Vines. He is an executive producer of The Vampire Chronicles, a television show based on the best-selling novels by his mother, Anne Rice. And together they penned Ramsay the Damned, The Passion of Cleopatra. With his best friend and producing partner, New York Times bestselling novelist Aaron Shaw Quinn, he also runs a podcast that we're going to talk about later called The Dinner Party Show. And I put a link to his website where you can find all of those things. So be sure to click on that anytime and check that out. And without any further delay, Chris, you there?
I'm here.
Yay! Well, happy Halloween, a little early.
A happy Halloween season. Happy autumn. We're not really having much of an autumn here in California right now. It feels more like summer, but yes, right? It is the season.
But the fires are out, right? So you're all good there.
The fires in Southern California are mostly under control. I think the one that really choked us here in Los Angeles is still technically burning, but it is. They got the upper hand on it a few days ago. But I've been here almost 20 years, and I have never experienced something like that. I've never experienced smoke sitting over the city that heavy and that long. It was quite a difficult experience for a lot of us, especially those of us with breathing problems. So.
Right. Yeah, the air quality was really scary. I was seeing because I've been in San Diego my whole life, and then we just moved to Florida, and my friends are posting pictures on Facebook of the red sky and the sun. I'm like, this is like a sci-fi movie. Wild.
Yeah, it was really the most interesting thing to my eye was the sunrise. I'm kind of an early riser, and that was really the only time of day when you could see the sun, and it would be blood red. Even when the sky around it seemed a more sort of hazy, muted color, the sun light would literally make the wildfire smoke evident by itself. It was unbelievable. It was like something out of a science fiction movie, like you said. But Northern California has been consistently way worse, I think, than we've had it down here.
Yeah, scary times. Well, while we're speaking of scary times, you had a new book come out, and it's the third book in your Burning Girl series, Blood Victory. Do you want to tell everybody why they should go get it today?
Well, yeah, they should go get it because it's good and it's scary. It's also, I would say, it's the third in a series, and most people like to start with the first one, which is Bone Music. So I would, if someone's curious, I recommend starting there. That's sort of the origin story for the heroine of the piece, which is Charlotte Rowe. Who is Charlotte Rowe, I should say. I really wrote this series because I was traumatized by horror movies as a little boy, particularly the ones in which some crazy masked killer got away with murder again and again and again, literally. And I wanted to invent a heroine who was strong enough and superpowered enough to go after those types of sadistic killers and just throttle their butts, if you'll excuse the expression. So I invented a young woman named Charlotte Rowe who is administered an experimental pharmaceutical, we should say, that gives her a burst of super strength that lasts for about 3 hours. And the circumstances under which she slipped this drug in the first book are sort of nefarious and deceptive, and that's the sort of foundation of that story. But she comes to embrace it and to develop a relationship with the drug makers, and she forms a partnership with them that allows her to pursue and go after these really diabolical serial killers and essentially pose as a possible victim so that they will abduct her, take her back to their lair or their kill site, and then once she's got them in the presence of the evidence of who they are, she overpowers them and turns the tables on them. And I think that's really, that moment of turning the tables is really why I wrote the series.
And you had to wait 3 books to get there.
Kind of. I mean, and the second book is about her sort of settling into her hometown life and discovering that there's a plot close to home that she needs to use her powers against. And you get a glimpse of her in operation. But by the time we got to the third book, I was like, okay, all of the characters are in the places they need to be for her to really make a mission of this. And so that's what she does. And it's kind of a road trip from hell that she goes on. She identifies, and working with the intelligence officers, that she identifies the serial killing truck driver, who is functioning in an analog world. So he's not texting anyone. He's not on the internet doing searches relevant to his crimes. And so they have to put him under physical surveillance, and she has to get abducted, and she has to be willing to sort of stave off the drug's effect. The drug is triggered when she's terrified. So if she can control her fear long enough, she can act like a normal victim for as long as she needs to take this road trip from hell to its final destination. So that's basically the long and short of it, but she's got no real sense of what's waiting for them at the end of the road. But they do have kind of a sense that this guy is not working alone. And so that all, once she gets abducted. So the point was, it's supposed to sort of take off like a rocket from the moment of her abduction on. And I wanted to write a book that literally never stopped moving, you know, like it just kept going, like those road trip movies that we all love.
Right, right. Yeah, so you were exhausted by the time you finished writing it, right?
I have to tell you, it was an interesting experience because you never had to, as a writer, I've never had to dial the pace down too far or dial it up again. Staying in that zone of just like, you know, tires going over pavement actually made it kind of a more exhilarating experience, and I was sort of amped up by the time I finished it. You know, like I wanted to send her back out on the road again immediately, but it was it was a fascinating experience. It was really fun to have built this world over the course of 2 books and to be confident enough in these characters that they could all begin to work together. Because in the previous books, they're all at each other's throats. Nobody's getting along, and it was a process to sort of get them into alliances with each other.
Right. And is this the final book in the series, or are there going to be more adventures for Charlotte?
I think there will be more adventures for Charlotte. I do. I think that this definitely answers some questions about her journey that I think readers might have wanted answers to over the course of 2 books. And I think this is, but there are still questions yet to be answered. And I think she is not done. She does not feel as if she has satisfied her mission. Charlie's journey is really defined by the fact that when she was a little girl, when she was a baby, I should say, her mother was abducted with her in the car and by 2 serial killers who murdered her mother and then attempted to raise Charlie as their own child. And she was discovered and rescued by law enforcement at age 7, and her father then exploited her experience for every dollar he could, just marching her out in front of the cameras and putting her on book tours when she was a little girl, and really kind of not a great dad. So she's always had this dark legacy hanging over her head and this dark suspicion by some people that maybe she was more affected by in early life by these serial killer parents than she's let on. And so her need to bring justice and to hunt these killers is really driven by that. And that's not something that can be expunged from a character in just a few books.
Right, right. And I had told you before the show, but when I was listening, I listened to the audiobook of that first one of Bone Music, and it was so unsettling, her flashback to being a little kid of where they were teaching her about the incinerator and all this kind of thing. It made me so uncomfortable. reading because the idea that you are serial killers born or are they, you know, made? And so anyway, it was really unsettling and amazing in a cool way, you know, just that you dug into that. Did you do a bunch of research? How did you come up with all those ideas?
I've been darkly obsessed with true crime my entire life, really. I would say adulthood, but I think I became fixated with it. And I feel like it's a generational thing for a lot of us. I have friends who are around my age, and we grew up in the age of child abductions and murders being splashed all over the news. The murder of Adam Walsh was a sort of searing cultural event and a terrible loss. And John Walsh, of course, went on to become this crusader for the rights of those who had lost loved ones to homicide. And living in Northern California in the 80s, it was a story that was there a lot. I remember other boys going missing and children being the sense of not living in a world that was entirely safe. And I think we're it's an interesting, I don't know if you've seen, there's a documentary on HBO Max now called Class Action Park, which is about this amusement park. It's an odd thing to bring up because it's a hilarious documentary. But it's about this amusement park in New Jersey during the late 70s or like 80s where there were no rules. Like, it was the most dangerous amusement park
Oh, like
in
Pleasure
America.
Island.
Yeah, people got injured, all this sort of stuff. But what they talk about is this sense that like the people who grew up during that period felt very unsupervised, and they felt like they learned and experienced so much difficulty and danger about the world that it resulted in the kind of helicopter parenting generation we have now. Anyway, that's a really long and fancy pants way of saying I was really obsessed with trying to. The thing about a true crime obsession is that it's different from a horror obsession because true crime offers some potential for resolution. A lot of true crime
Right.
stories are written about the people who were caught, who went to trial, who were convicted. I mean, there are a lot of stories out there about miscarriages of justice as well. But it's really about it's about the resolution. That's what the
Right.
fixation is about for me. So that was always there, but serial killers always captivated me. And I think I was always captivated in part by the fact that we have a strange cultural relationship to them. We have people who sort of glamorize them in ways that make me uncomfortable. And I think we have some theories about what makes a serial killer that aren't necessarily supported by science, and they evolve over time. So all of that was swimming around in my head, but I also just fundamentally love stories about strong women kicking butt. Like it's my favorite genre.
I appreciate that as well. I also wanted to mention, have you ever watched The Following, that Kevin Bacon show with the serial killer who was fashioning himself after Edgar Allan Poe? Anyway, they
I
had
did.
scenes
Yeah,
with the
I watched the
child,
first
and
season. Yeah.
yeah, man, that was a scary, unsettling show too. But I thought if
Yeah,
you're into that, it's really good.
I think it's an interesting question because I think with those Charlie scenes you're talking about, what we see is two people trying to raise someone as if killing people you hate is normal. And that's what's so
Right.
terrifying, because what's terrifying to me is the villain never knows they're the villain. That's kind of the secret to life. Like the villains I like at least, or who I think read the best on the page, don't believe that they are fundamentally evil. And I think the serial
Right.
killers often delude themselves into believing they are punishing someone for a transgression or a crime, that deep down their victims deserve it, that they incited it, all that sort of crazy, terrifying stuff. And so really getting into that twisted logic with a character like Charlie who can blow it apart, and killers to their needs, that's really satisfying to me as a reader at least.
Yeah, and it's cool that you can pull in things that fascinate you anyway, and then twist it around to see it, from all angles. I thought that was really cool.
Thank you.
And I have to ask, because we're all living it right now, but I've been asking everyone who comes on the show, what are you doing to keep writing during a pandemic? In one way, it's like we've trained for this because we are in our writing cave
Yes.
writing. But in another, I mean, a lot of people like to go out to write, and that's not happening now. And it's hard to, write scary things when the world is scary. So how are you doing it? What's writing during a pandemic look like for you?
Well, for me, it's been interesting. The thing that I missed the most was that there was usually one day out of the week where I would go to my favorite restaurant that had kind of a lunch counter, And I would sit there and write for hours. And I had my favorite servers, and they would bring me my favorite pot of tea and all that sort of stuff. I miss
right.
that. I do.
Me too.
But I do agree with you mostly that we were prepared for this as writers. And I think that for me, it turned into, I had started doing this before the pandemic, and it kind of kept working, which is I was actually working on two different projects a day. I would write something that was heavier and dark first thing, and then in the afternoon I began working on something that was really probably the most romantic thing I've ever written, and I'm still tinkering with it and figuring out what I'm going to do with it. But it was a much lighter gay romance set in a luxury hotel. So,
oh,
yeah,
my gosh.
It was,
oh, my gosh.
And it
when
was
is that
saving,
coming out?
I don't know. I'm still working on it. I envision it as part of a trilogy. So I'm kind of thinking maybe I'll try to write all three before I even make
all
a
three.
Plan for it. Yeah.
But the world needs it now.
No, well, right. And it's set in a hotel, and I was writing it as hotels were closing and having these horrible. I kind of feel like hotels are coming back faster than restaurants are now. But so that was my sanity giver, is that I would lighten things up later in the day. But the other aspect of this for me is that I'm single and I live alone. And I think there was an arc to that. Like in the beginning of the pandemic, all of my family and friends, if you will, were saying, oh, that must be so hard for you. You're all by yourself. I would go crazy if I were completely alone. And then 3 months later, they were like, I want to put my children in a closet and lock it and slide food under the door. They're driving me crazy. I want these. And I'm sitting here like, I get to decide what I watch on TV tonight, and there will be no disagreements or arguments. So that's been part of it. But anyone who lives a life of the mind, I think is maybe doing a little bit better than this. I'm not a huge social person. Like I like to go out and do social things because they make feeling being at home feel better again once I get home again. Like it's the contrast sharpens
then
the pleasure of what I enjoy
it.
Doing. Yes, exactly.
Right.
So that's
yeah, and
a long
if you
and
never
short
get
of it.
To go out, then it becomes, you know, normal.
Right, absolutely. I also have space, which I'm very grateful for. I'm blessed to have a home where I've got some different rooms and I can move around a bit. I think my friends in New York who were in tiny apartments when they were just going through the worst of it, they were really, I think their mental health was really under strain, and I felt very bad for a lot of them. So I was glad to see them start to trickle out into the world again and be able to get out in a safe way.
Yeah, yeah. For sure. So for people who haven't, you know, really interacted with you much online, you're very active on Twitter. But tell people about the Dinner Party Show. That's your podcast. And now you guys are doing true crime. Like, it's amazing. Want to tell everybody about it?
Well, yeah, of course. So it's a partnership with my best friend, Eric Shaw Quinn, who is also a writer, and I think he's hilarious and very talented, and everyone should check out his Right Murder mystery series. The first one is out. It's called Right Murder. It's about a ghostwriter and a celebrity he works for who get entangled in a big Hollywood murder mystery, and it's very, very comic and very sharp and very witty. And I thought forever,
fun.
We had been friends forever, and I thought we should... He has such a great radio voice and such a great voice in general. I had always wanted to do something with him where we had microphones in front of us. So a couple of years ago, we started what was really more of a live internet radio show called The Dinner Party Show, which involves sketch comedy and celebrity interviews. And we did it. We would stream it live through our website every night, every Sunday, I should say. And we did it for about 3 years. And then we were both working on development of the Vampire Chronicles series, or we sort of got deeply involved in that, and it took away our time for it. So we put it on hiatus. We did some work on YouTube, filmed some videos on YouTube, and then the Vampire Chronicles sort of took us away from that. So a little while ago, podcasting became more of a thing after we started the Dinner Party Show. It was really not what it was now. Everyone thought this internet radio thing was going to be a big deal. So when I went with some friends to a podcast recording of My Favorite Murder in San Diego, actually, your former hometown. And
yeah.
I was so taken with the way the host just were sort of them. Like, they just got on stage and they were funny, and it's a hugely popular podcast. The audience was like 2,000 people. And I thought, well, Eric and I should really try something where we don't have to produce all the sketches. We're not dealing with in-studio celebrity interviews, all of which logistically require some work. We're going to sort of express ourselves in front of the microphones and have a conversation like we have every evening on the phone. And after we started it, after a few episodes, Eric was the one who brought up the idea of Christopher and Eric's True Crime TV Club. Because we wanted to think of something, we were trying to do something that we could integrate into the other work that we were doing that wasn't going to take over our lives as much as the previous show had. And so we thought, well, what are we already doing? And Eric said, we watch a lot of true crime documentaries. So we can talk about an hour of television that we've both watched, and we can sort of serve it up for the people listening where they can watch ahead. We'll let them know what we're going to talk about, but they don't have to. It's not a requirement. And this is what we'll do. So that's one thing out of several that we do. We also watch sort of kooky paranormal investigative shows and assess whether mm-hmm. or not there was any scientific method used. And it's been fun. And we're so grateful that we have figured out a way to record them remotely during the pandemic. I think otherwise that would have really brought us to a halt. But I think a lot of podcasters have figured out how to It's not necessarily the easiest process, but the sound quality has stayed strong and good, and it's given us something to focus on during those long periods at home that I think has been productive. So I hope people enjoy it. All the podcasts can be downloaded or streamed from thedinnerpartyshow.com, but they should also be on every podcast platform people prefer.
Right. And it's also cool. I mean, I try to find bright spots where I can, but I think the pandemic has been really cool in helping everyone learn how to use Zoom, how to use, you know, mm-hmm. their video on their phone to talk to people and that kind of thing, just so we can stay connected during this crazy year.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think there is power in Zoom. Like, I thought, well, you know, I'm texting people, I'm calling them, what's the big deal? But just looking into somebody else's eyes is so,
yeah.
if you're in
yeah.
home as much as we are, yeah, it's
right.
comforting.
It is. And to see that they too look tired. Like,
mm-hmm.
okay, I'm all right.
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I wanted to also touch on, like, the Dinner Party Show. I think taps into that part of you. When we've talked before, we've talked about your writing journey and how you didn't think you were going to be a writer, right? Didn't you think you were going to be an actor?
I did. I thought I was going to be an actor. And I had dreams when I went to college of, you know, Good Will Hunting was a big success. And Matt Damon and Ben Affleck had written that screenplay and acted it. And I really thought that was going to be my path. I look back on it now and I'm not sure if I was a little like, too self-conscious, I think, to be an actor. Like, there was more going on in my head than outside my head. And so I may have ended up on the right path, you know, but I auditioned for a lot of plays my freshman year of college and just didn't get called back for anything. And it was really crushing. Because I had been such a theater kid in high school that I just thought, oh, they're waiting for me. And
right.
I went back to my dorm room and nobody could stop me from writing. Nobody could take that outlet away from me. So I started writing some, you know, not great plays. You know, my mother always cringes when I criticize my early work, but it's like, man, they weren't great, but they were a beginning. And I think it was a natural extension of the fact that I was always a voracious reader. And I think that
mm-hmm.
most writers are writing what they want to read. If they're writing stuff they're excited about, they're writing what they want to read. And that's what I started doing.
Yeah. And I love, too, that didn't you tell me before that your mom didn't know you were writing a book and then you presented it and she was like, what? Is that how it happened?
Yeah, she had no idea. I had moved out to L.A. young with some friends of mine and we were developing, I put in air quotes, screenplays. And she got very sick. She went into a diabetic coma. She didn't know she had diabetes. And I flew home to be with her and decided Mardi Gras was coming up. So as she began to recover, I decided to just stay. but I had none of my screenplay files with me. This was in the long before the cloud was a thing.
Right.
So I just started working on this short story that I had in my hard drive and became my first novel, A Density of Souls. Like it just grew and grew and grew. And I think the way I was able to do it was by keeping the stakes really low in my head. Like I was, you know, by not, if I had said I am writing a novel that will be well suited to publication in a year's time, I would have freaked out. Like I would have had a, you know, I could, no. But it's just one day at a time, I just kept pecking away at it. And then at the end of 3 months, it was manuscript length. It wasn't ready for publication. It needed major editing. But it was, and so, yeah, I shocked her and I said, I wrote a book, and she was completely stunned. Nobody thought I would. I never thought I would either. The thing about screenwriting was that it seemed like all the hard work would be done by somebody else, you know?
Right.
That was really appealing when I was in my early 20s. Right, exactly.
Oh, and that's so funny because when you were writing Ramsey's, the Cleopatra book with your mom, you were telling me that you were sending it to her for edits and she kept telling you about hats, right? You had
more
to write
hats.
In more hats.
more hats. Yes, because it was the Edwardian era and, you know, Anne Rice is all about those sensual details. And
those time periods.
There were not enough hats. There were not enough hats.
Yeah, so you needed to get all those tiny details working with your mom.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So you've already talked about your secret gay romance in the big hotel that we all need right now, but what else are you working on? I'm assuming the vampires are still on hold because of the plague, right?
Yeah, that's it. The vampires were in a good place before the plague, and they've been put on pause. But they're healthy and alive, and you know, it's just pause
they're
is
immortal.
Good. You know, they're immortal. They'll live forever. Yeah, AMC really is invested in this universe, and they have the rights to the vampires and the witches, and so which are connected universes in the books. So
right.
They will possibly be connected in the shows as well. So that's very exciting. But yeah,
cool.
There's not much to report on that, and I know people are getting frustrated with the lack of updates, but it's really a COVID thing.
Right. Right. Yeah, the plague shut everything down.
Yeah, I think there's another collaboration, book length collaboration with my mother that's currently a secret, so I can't go into too much detail about it. Yes.
What?
I will just dangle that out there.
I can't wait.
And I'll be doing another thriller. I'll be doing a standalone thriller with Amazon Publishing, the same people I've worked with on the Burning Girl series. And so that's exciting, too.
Okay.
And I just started work on that. So, yeah, it's a lot of – I've stayed busy. That's how I've stayed sane. I've stayed busy.
Yeah, well, that's good. And before we run out of time, I always ask during Halloween season, what was your best Halloween costume ever?
Well, you know, there were there's a division in my Halloweening life. There's my Halloween experiences as a child, and then there are my Halloween experiences as a gay man living in West Hollywood. And let's just say the orientations of the costumes were very different. As a child, it was more sort of pumpkins and whatever. And as a grown-up gay man, I decided for a couple years in a row to go as the athletes I had never been in high school. So I think my baseball player costume was the biggest success, and I'll just leave it
baseball
at that.
Cruise.
Yeah, baseball.
Okay.
I was a convincing baseball player, probably a less convincing football player, more of a more convincing baseball player. So yeah.
Okay. And then what's your favorite Halloween movie that we should all watch this year?
I have to say, the original Halloween is pretty terrifying.
Oh,
and it's not excessively gory and just sort of, you know, frightening. I think the sequels went into crazy town, but the original one is terrifying. I think in terms of like less scary, there are some like, is Hocus Pocus a Halloween movie?
Yes, it happens on Halloween. It's one of my favorites. I love that one. The
yeah.
Sanderson sisters.
It was,
yeah,
I saw it for the first time actually recently, and I thought that's a pretty cute and charming Halloween movie. Anything that, for me, Halloween is like autumn in New England. Anything that evokes autumn in New England is great. And I'm particularly hungry for that because we don't have autumn here in California.
Right, right.
Maybe ever again.
Yeah, you got to live it through the movies.
Right, exactly. So that's going to be my jam.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for being here. I wish we had more time, but everyone go check out Blood Victory. It is on Amazon in audio, ebook, hardcover, paperback. Go grab your copy. And Chris, thanks so much for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Lisa, and I hope
you have fun.
Thanks for joining us on BookLight.
Thank you.
Be sure to connect with us at www.readersentertainment.com for articles, blogs, videos, and podcasts that matter to readers.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.